Welcome back to Mini Med Pods. I'm Xiao.
And I'm Simran.
Thank you so much for listening to us. Today we're going to have a chat about fever in a returned traveller. Just to let you know, we're recording this around COVID era. So if you do see a returned traveller presenting with a fever, you got it. You always have to think COVID until proven otherwise. But today our discussion will be mainly on the non-COVID stuff. And what we're going to do is we're going to take a slightly different approach. We're going to have a discussion. We're going to explore topics and conditions that are specific to the return traveler, as well as conditions that are not so specific to the return traveler. You know, Australians who've been in Australia for many, many years can also get it, but it's something that we also need to consider when we're doing this topic. So without rambling on for too much, Simran, take it away.
All right. So we're just going to take a different approach to today's sort of podcast. I feel like fever and return traveler, there's so many differentials that you can be thinking about. And it can sometimes be quite overwhelming if we were to go through each of them, you know, like didactically. So I think we'll try to make it a discussion. So just before I actually give some sort of cases and we get talking, Xiao, when you think of fever and a return traveler, what are your top differentials or what are some conditions you're thinking about?
Yeah, so just based on the experiences that I've had, as well as the lectures that we go to, the weird and wonderful stuff that you can get overseas, but not so much in Australia, are things like malaria, dengue, typhoid. You can also get things like hepatitises, especially hep A and hep E, because they're not endemic to our country. And then I'm also thinking of other things that are common in Australia as well as overseas, such as hep B, hep C, HIV. So yes, you're right. There's just a really big breadth of what people could get. And of course, one that I nearly forgot is TB. And you can actually find TB not only in just return travelers, but also people who are born overseas in endemic countries.
Yeah, absolutely. That was actually an amazing list of differentials. And I like how you divide into what are endemic in other countries that you wouldn't see in Australia and what are some conditions that you could also see in Australia, but also you could get if you were traveling. So that was really good. So I'm going to give you a few cases and we're going to have a discussion about these conditions that you've mentioned and maybe some more. So case number one, you've got a patient who comes into you and says, "Doc, I'm not feeling so well. I've got this fever. I'm feeling a bit headachy. I've got a cough, some tummy pain. I've also got some loose stools. And I've also noticed my skin's turning a bit yellow." And when you take a further history, you realize that he's actually come back from Africa a week ago. And he's been having these symptoms for about 2 days.
Okay, so I think from what you said, they're having a cough, a cold, it seems like horizontal symptoms, they've got jaundice, they also come back with a fever, and they've had it for 2 days, and they just came back from Africa. I think my top differential would be malaria?
Yeah, sorry, I don't think I clarified about the fever. So the fever, if it comes and goes, what would you think?
Oh, definitely malaria. Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
So, fever. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, I forgot to give that key information. So based on that, I guess the two things you want to focus on is the cyclical fever. So the fever that comes and goes, and with the associated jaundice, you'd want to think in a return traveler, you'd want to think your top differential is malaria. So that's good. So just a bit about malaria. It's actually caused by a parasite, which is transferred through a mosquito bite, usually from the family of the Anopheles mosquito. And malaria can be, like, these mosquitoes are usually nighttime biters. So that's kind of like buzzwordy for that. In terms of prevention, for someone who comes into your clinic and says, "Oh, I'm going to be traveling, let's say again to Africa, is there anything I should do beforehand?" I think it's really important to educate patients about the risk of malaria and what they can do before traveling, during their travel, and when they come back. So before they travel, they can take some sort of prophylactic medication to kind of prevent them from getting malaria or prevent them from getting a serious form of malaria. So the two most common ones are doxycycline and mefloquine. And they can basically take this about a week or so before they travel. They take it for the duration of their stay in the malaria endemic area. And then they continue it for about a week or so, maybe a bit longer, when they come back. And that's just to protect them from getting any severe form of malaria, because it can be quite, it can lead to a lot of dehydration, and it's just a protective factor. There are some things that they can also do when they are traveling. Xiao, do you know what things you could recommend to a patient who's traveling to a malaria endemic country about what they can do during their stay?
For sure. So things like lifestyle non-medication based prevention is things like wearing mosquito repellent, wearing light colored clothes with long sleeves and shirts, as well as long pants. That's because for some odd reason, mosquitoes tend to like dark colored clothing. Mosquito nets are particularly important, especially over your bed. And then avoid any outside activities between dusk as well as dawn. And if you are staying in the country, avoid sort of going to areas where there's lots of still water. So either little ponds, little lakes, try to avoid those areas.
Yeah, that was really good. So in this situation, Xiao, if you do suspect that a patient might have malaria and you have to do one test, what investigation of choice would you choose?
I think if they're back in Australia and they have good pathology, a thick and thin film would be really good.
Good, that's the investigation of choice. And do you know anything about management? Like, there's a lot of management options for malaria, but any sort of medications that come to mind when you think about malaria?
I think the medication that comes into mind is artemisinin-based combination. So that's artemether and lumefantrine. There are other things like quinines. Quinines are also pretty good at managing malaria.
Mm-hmm. Good. So that was kind of your quick sort of intro and discussion about malaria. So let's move on to the next case. So Xiao, you've got a patient who comes in and says, "Doc, I've got this really bad fever. It's just not going away. And I just recently came back from Thailand." And upon further history, you notice that he tells you that, you know, "I've got this really bone-breaking back pain. Got this pain behind my eyes. I've also noticed this rash developing around my body. And when I'm just recently, I've noticed that, you know, when I go brush my teeth, my gums bleed really easily, and I've been getting some nose bleeding and also some bruising. I'm really worried. You know, what do you think is going on, Doc?"
So just to summarize what the case was, it sounds like he just came back from overseas. He's got a fever. He's got bone-breaking pain, more specifically bone-breaking back pain. He's also got retroorbital headache. And it sounds like he's having some kind of thrombocytopenia. And that's because when he's brushing his teeth, his gums are bleeding, he's getting nosebleeds. And it's possible that that rash might be to do with it. And of course, the bruising as well. So this is all telling me he most likely has dengue.
You are such a genius. Absolutely. So dengue is a viral infection, and it's caused by, it's also caused by a mosquito bite similar to malaria, but it's a different mosquito. So it's called the Aedes aegypti mosquito. I hope I pronounced that well. Now the difference between malaria and dengue in terms of the mosquito is the most common time that you'd get the mosquito bite. So dengue is mostly caused by daytime biters, and malaria is caused mainly by nighttime biters. So usually, like, if you have a patient who comes with a fever and return travel, you want to ask them, like, "Did you have any mosquito bites?" And if they're like, "Yes, I did," then you want to ask, like, "Was it mainly during the day or during the night?" So with dengue, it would be mainly during the day. And then they'd obviously have the associated bone-breaking back pain, retroorbital pain, a rash, and you're right, thrombocytopenia. So dengue itself is endemic in Cambodia, Vietnam, Thailand, among other places. But if you have someone coming from these areas, you really want to have a high index of suspicion for dengue. So Xiao, if you had to choose one investigation to diagnose dengue, what would you choose?
First, can I just say, thank you so much for calling me a genius. I don't get to, no one really calls me that every day. So thank you so much. but in terms of what I would order first, the one that I would order, because it's a virus, PCRs are usually very good. So you can do a tissue PCR, serum PCR, or plasma PCR.
Good. And is there any other cool investigation or test you could do with dengue?
Cool investigations. Yes, I believe so. So dengue, your body's obviously going to try to fight against the dengue. So you can actually look for the antibodies. So you can do an immunological serology, and you can look for the IgM and IgG that are sort of like your anti-dengue antibodies, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. And mainly you don't really do that. You mainly just do the PCR. Another really cool investigation you can do is something called a tourniquet test. So that's basically when you basically put a tourniquet around the patient's arm. And after a few seconds or a few minutes, you'll basically see these little red dots forming. And that's basically due to the thrombocytopenia. And it's a positive sort of test result can support your diagnosis of typhoid along with the characteristic. Sorry, dengue. I'm so sorry. Dengue. Not typhoid, dengue, and support your diagnosis of dengue. All right, so given that dengue is caused by a virus, what would be the mainstay treatment for someone who comes in with dengue?
So I think with viruses, you can sort of treat it a bit like a cold. Unless they're super, super sick, then please go to hospital. So it's mainly supportive therapy. Unfortunately, there's no antiviral for dengue at this moment in time. So give them lots of fluids. Make sure they eat as much as comfortable. Give them paracetamol for their fever. And once again, if they're really sick, for example, this guy has thrombocytopenia, if you clinically assess that you're not very happy with that, then consider admitting him into hospital, get ID involved, and get him involved. But otherwise, it's mostly, like I said, supportive therapy.
Yeah, good. That was really thorough. Thanks, Xiao. All right, so that kind of completes that case. Now I'm going to move on to another case. So, Xiao, you've got another patient who comes in, says, "Doc, I've got this fever. I've just come back from, where have I come back from? Just come back from Nepal, and this fever just came on a few days ago. I've also been having a lot of loose stools, some tummy pain. I've also vomited a few times, and I just feel really, really nauseous. I've also noticed this rash that looks like these rose spots. When you take a further history, you notice that this patient, during their travel, actually had a lot of street food, didn't really pay attention to whether, you know, he drank tap water or bottled water, probably had a bit of both. So based on the risk factors and the presentation, what do you think is going on?
So once again, summarizing the case, it sounds like he's a return traveler from Nepal, I believe, and he has a fever. He's also having diarrhea, sort of gastro-like symptoms, but what's not gastro-like is the rash, the rose spot rash. And another thing to keep in mind is he's been eating, he mentions that he's been eating lots of street food, local food, and local water without being too careful. So because he is presenting with this fever, he's very sick, he's got a rash, it's not so much gastro, I'm thinking it's probably typhoid.
Yeah, exactly. So typhoid, you're absolutely right what you said. And typhoid itself is a bacterial infection, and it has a characteristic presentation of something that looks like gastroenteritis. And ways that you can differentiate it from gastroenteritis is the fact that, you know, he's got a rash, rose spots. The fact that he's come from a typhoid endemic area. So places where you want to, like, typhoid endemic regions include Nepal, Bangladesh, and India. So if you have someone coming in from these regions, you want to think about typhoid. Again, obviously, this is not a hard and fast rule. They could be coming in from another country and still have typhoid, but these are the three sort of top areas you want to think about. So Xiao, if you had to choose one investigation, what would be your investigation of choice?
Since it's a bacteria, and it's probably floating around in the blood since he's getting this rash, probably blood culture.
Bingo. Absolutely. You are 100% correct. Okay, so you've got your investigation. They definitely have typhoid. What would be basics in management? What would you, like, apart from, like, you know, your supportive, your rest, fluids, analgesia, antiemetics, what kind of medication would you want to give for someone who has typhoid?
Well, I think it's really important to remember that typhoid is a bacteria, so antibacterials, and specifically ceftriaxone.
Absolutely. Good. That basically covers our typhoid. So we've so far covered malaria, dengue, and typhoid, which are, again, endemic to other regions or other countries and not so commonly seen in Australia. It's not endemic in Australia. So I'm going to give you one more case that's sort of that you would see more commonly outside of Australia, and then we'll talk about more common ones after that. So you've got a patient who comes in and says, "Doc, I've got this really, really bad fever. I've just come back from Africa and I've been having this cough. You know, I've been, you know, producing a lot of sputum. I've also noticed some blood in the sputum. And I just feel really, really short of breath. I've noticed that my pants have become really, really loose. I just feel so tired. And when I wake up in the morning, I'm drenched in sweat. I've also got some, you know, some notes and swelling I've noticed, like lumps around my neck. I'm just really, really worried." And when you take a further history, you notice that this person was actually born in Afghanistan and came to Australia about 10 years ago. Based on this presentation, Shell, what would you think? What would be your top differential?
So this person has just came back from Africa, but they were actually born in Afghanistan. So they're born overseas. They've got fever, cough, hemoptysis, possibly unexpected loss of weight. They're feeling really fatigued. It's all sounding a little bit like tuberculosis.
All right. So Shell, you're absolutely correct. It is TB. So I'm just going to give a bit of information about TB because it's quite a complex topic in itself. And I think we can maybe do another podcast if, you know, if it's a bit more confusing. So TB can be divided into a primary or a secondary infection. Primary is when, you know, you get infected and that's like your primary sort of TB. It can either be latent TB or active TB. Latent is when you get the infection, but you don't exhibit any symptoms. And active is when you actually exhibit symptoms. Most primary TB infections are latent. About 1 to 5% of them can be active where a person is symptomatic. But most patients who come with symptomatic TB more commonly have secondary TB, where you've got where they've been infected in the past, they didn't present with symptoms, it was latent, and it comes back and they become symptomatic. So it kind of resurfaces. So if you've got a patient like this who is symptomatic and you're suspecting TB, there are certain sort of tests or investigations you can do. So you can do a sputum culture with microscopy looking for doing a Ziehl-Neelsen stain. And that'll basically show acid fast bacilli. And you can also do imaging. So your imaging of choice would be chest x-ray. So the chest x-ray will differ based on whether this is a primary infection or a secondary infection. So it's really good with differentiating between those two types. So in a primary infection, you'd see a GON complex, which is a GON focus that consists of a caseating granuloma plus lymphadenopathy. That's sort of the primary sort of presentation for primary TB infection. For a secondary TB infection, it mainly affects the upper lobes. So you'll see cavitating lesions in the upper lobes of a person who's got secondary TB infection. Those are your investigations. In terms of management, I'm sure, I'm hoping that those who have studied TB or have been introduced to it have heard the mnemonic RIPE, which is rifampicin, isoniazid, pyrazinamide, and ethambutol. So someone who's got active TB, like this patient, you want to give them all four of these medications, but the duration is different. So you give rifampicin, isoniazid for 6 months, and you give pyrazinamide and ethambutol for 2 months. So right now, this patient, you put them on all four of those medications, so RIPE. After 2 months, you take them off the pyrazinamide and the ethambutol and tell them to continue the rifampicin and isoniazid for 4 months. All right. So that's just a bit of an introduction. We might do a separate podcast on this, but that's just sort of basics of TB. I hope that wasn't too much. All right. So now just doing a segue, Xiao, I'm just going to give you some presentation and I want you to tell me what kind of differentials you're thinking about. So you've got a patient who comes in and says, "Doc, I'm not feeling so well. I've got this fever." And during your history, you notice that this patient actually had unprotected sex during their travel. They also, and they had unprotected sex with multiple partners. They also shared needles with the people that they were traveling with. So given that risk profile, what kind of differentials would you be thinking about?
So the differentials I have with sort of unprotected sexual contact with multiple people is sexually transmitted diseases. But because you added sort of the needle sharing and we're sort of adding bloodborne, I'm marrying the two categories and that comes up with HIV, Hep B, and Hep C.
Mm-hmm. So how would you differentiate between these three then?
So I think HIV is probably easiest to differentiate from the hepatitises. So HIV, you get a lot of flu-like symptoms. So you get your myalgia. You might kind of feel like you're really tired. You can get lymphadenopathy. But yeah, it is very, very non-specific kind of symptoms. And of course, you get fever as well. Then you have the hepatitises, which are really difficult to differentiate from each other, B and C. But in terms of the hepatitis picture, you're going to get the right quadrant abdominal pain, right upper quadrant abdominal pain, as well as you can get fever, you can get jaundice, yellowing of the eyes, yellowing of the skin, and you can also have the viral type picture, which is like your aches and pains, your muscle aches and pains, being really fatigued. And then in terms of investigations, which is probably where you're going to really nut out the differences, for HIV, you can order a rapid test, which will give you sort of a screening method way to see if this person has HIV or not. And then for the hepatitises, well, you can order the hepatitis serology. And I think one thing that's really important that even though we're trying to differentiate all of them, we still need to consider comorbidities. So people can actually have Hep B, Hep C, as well as HIV. So sometimes it is just better to screen all of them.
That was actually a really good point that you made, Shelly. You're right. Like a person who comes with fever, they might not just have one thing. They could have multiple things going on. And so it's important to actually be mindful of the fact that even if, like, let's say you tested for hepatitis, if a person has risk factors for HIV, such as, you know, needle sharing, men who have sex with men, having multiple partners, you still want to screen for HIV because they could have both of them. You never know. And you're absolutely right when it comes to differentiating it. A lot of it is not just the history, but also the investigations that you do. So with HIV, you can do the screening, which is a rapid test. And in terms of diagnosis and confirmatory tests, you can also do Western blot. You can also do a viral load to look at the presence of any HIV RNA. And yeah, with hepatitis, you're right. With hepatitis B and C, it's actually really difficult to differentiate based on history because the presentation will be really similar and the risk factors might also be really similar. So the serology itself will help to differentiate whether they have Hep B or C or something else. So yeah, that's really good. So now let's give a different risk profile. You've got a patient comes in with fever and they've got this fever. During my travel, you notice that, you know, they had a lot of street food. They drink a lot of tap water. So based on that sort of picture without nothing else, what would you be thinking?
So just based on the fact that they're just, I guess it's kind of nice. They're living the life and trying to explore local foods and water. But if you're not careful, there are a few diseases that you can be susceptible to. So we already talked about typhoid, which is the bacteria. Then you can also get the viruses, so Hep A and Hep E. And I believe the buzzwords for hip A is shellfish, and then the buzzwords for hip E is more water. And more water. I'll stick with water. Then you also need to think about the most common one, and that's just gastro. E. coli gastro is something that does happen, and that's commonly known as traveler's diarrhea. And then, yes, again, you can also have comorbidities in this particular category as well.
Yeah, that's really good. And you're right, like gastroenteritis is one of the most common causes of diarrhea. So when you have that kind of presentation and you've got someone who comes in with a fever and those risk factors, you want to ask, like, do you have loose stools? And to say yes, and you want to think, okay, you have typhoid. You might have typhoid, but you might also just have the most common thing, which is gastro. So yeah, that's really good. So I think the whole purpose of all these cases is just to get everyone thinking about, when you have someone coming in with a fever in a return traveler, what kind of questions you can ask to decipher risk factors, how you can cluster it. So, you know, whether they've if they've had unprotected sex, needle sharing, you want to think your bloodborne, so HIV, STI, hepatitis. If on the other end they didn't do any of that, but they had a lot of street food, tap water, then you want to think typhoid, gastro, Hep A, Hep E. If they've got a cyclical fever with jaundice, you're thinking, okay, malaria. If they've got this bone breaking back pain and pain behind their eyes, the back of their eyes, then you want to think, okay, likely dengue. If they've got the typical sort of picture that's kind of similar to gastro, but they've also got a rash, then you want to think, oh, and they come from an endemic area such as Nepal or Bangladesh or India, you want to think, oh, could this be typhoid? So it's always just having, you know, in your mind what kind of questions you want to ask. So just some tips and tricks when it comes to this. There's actually a really good mnemonic. It's called Chick Toads. So it's just a mnemonic to kind of help you structure your history in a fever and a return traveler. So Chick Toads stands for contacts. So did you have any sick contacts? Housing, so like where did you live? Did you live, you know, in a village? Did you live in the city? Did you live in any sort of accommodation? Immunizations. So did you get any immunizations before you traveled? Like, were your hepatitis immunizations up to date? Did you get was your tetanus up to date? Did you get your typhoid vaccine? In terms of country of origin, so like, where were you born? And that's really relevant when we talk about TB. Sexual contacts. So during your travel, were you sexually active? Did you have unprotected sex? Did you have sex with multiple partners? And then there's actually an F. So Chick F Toads. F would be the food and water. So did you have street food? Did you drink any tap water, or did you have bottled water? And then occupation. So, you know, what were you like? What was the reason for your travel? Was it a business trip? Was it just to travel? Animals and mosquitoes, so any animal bites, mosquito bites, any interaction with animals, and drugs. So did you use any IV drugs? Did you inject anything? Did you share needles? And swimming. So did you go swimming during your travel? And swimming can be associated with a lot of sort of infections, but the one you want to think about is schistosomiasis. I hope I pronounced that correct. And someone who presents with that, they'll have the risk factor. You know, they went swimming during their travel, and they might have associated abdominal pain, diarrhea, bloody stools, blood in their urine, some joint pain, itchy skin, some chills. So it's really important, as you can see, that not only is the area that the place that they travel important, but also their risk exposure is really important. So it's really important to assess for risk factors, have a good set of differentials in your mind. And just to kind of send the point home, just as just common points, these are not hard and fast rules, but if you've got someone coming from Africa and Papua New Guinea, think malaria. Someone coming from India, Bangladesh, or Nepal, think typhoid. Someone coming from Cambodia, Vietnam, or Thailand, think dengue. And yeah, I think that's all I had to say. I'm sure, I know this is a really long podcast, but I hope it was really helpful. Xiao, is there anything else you'd like to add or discuss?
No, thank you so much, Simran, for leading the discussion. And thank you guys for listening to us. We hope you had fun, just as much fun as I did being put on the spot, but it was actually really nice to know that my brain is working. So thank you so much once again. We hope you enjoyed it. If you loved what we did, we would appreciate you going onto our Facebook page on Mini Med Pods and giving us a like. That would be really nice. And also, don't forget to follow us on our Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts, or wherever you like to listen to your podcast, because we love it when we get new supporters. Anyways, for now, we shall say goodbye, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.